two quick stories that sort of begin on understanding the context of this man that is unnamed, the man who was carried every day into the temple. The beautiful gate is not outside the temple. It's not an entry point into the temple. It's you already are in the temple in the court of the Gentiles, and then you're going into to get to the beautiful gate. The beautiful gate is part of the sanctuary space. So he wasn't set outside of the temple. He was brought into the temple. And I chose the Psalm 130 passage because that's what I feel like his posture was. It says that he was waiting there to receive alms. In other words, alms, what are alms? Well, they're a part of people's worship. They receive the alms. They received the blessing of those who were coming to worship in the temple. So those alms were part of our obligation to the poor around us. And so he was there to make use of that practice. Part of the privilege of this trip, it was organized by my former assistant, Chaim Gindi, who's Egyptian, and she gathered a group of 17 people from large, most of them from Elkhart area, and I was grafted in. Dorothy and I were, since we had been part of that community as well, and one of the delights was being able to get to know some of her family. And her niece that traveled with us the entire time was born handicapped. Her legs really don't function very much. And we traveled by bus, by plane, by boat. And her name's Myrna, and she would handle herself in the bus, but she couldn't use her legs for that. She would scoot up the steps backwards using her hands, and then she'd scoot to her chair, and then somebody would have to come and pick her up. Usually it was her brother, would just lift her up and let her scooch into the sink, sit, chair. Bench, you know, a 60-seater bus. Now, the departure from the bus was much less dignified because she would sort of scooch herself over, like lift the arm, rest, you know, get herself over, and then she'd get to a certain point where she let herself plop down on the ground. And I thought, you know, it's amazing. This 25-year-old, maybe, really wants to be on this trip. She really wants to participate as much and as fully as she possibly can, even though it's in a context where handicapped access is not nearly what it is here in rough and difficult roads. But she wanted so much to be a part of this group that she was willing to deal with that on a daily basis. And that meant sitting out on certain things because it was just not feasible to carry her through. But she was a constant reminder to me of this man who had been handicapped from birth. Now, this man at the temple, though, was carried there by his friends. So if we think about that book that I was using on through the Lenten period, those people were part of his allies, and they were helping him to achieve his goals. They were helpers, allies who came along to walk with him and do what he could not do. He came, though, not for the act of worship himself. In fact, he sat at the edge of worship, and he was helping others to worship, but he was not in a position to worship by himself other than at a distance. When he saw Peter and John coming to the temple, we don't really know, did he know who they were at all? Did he expect anything from them other than simply alms? But what we do know is that he called out to them enough that they stopped and looked at him. Now, I don't know about you, but walking through the streets of Alexandria, or the little part of town where we were staying, there were dozens and dozens of beggars, but of different varieties. So you've got the ones who come with all of this stuff to sell you, you know. $1, $1 is all it takes, and you can have this as your own, you know. So these kids that follow you for a long time, pestering you to buy from them. So there's that kind. But then there are the ones who have some kind of physical issue, whatever that might be. And, you know, they're asking for help. They're asking for food. They're not necessarily pronouncing any kind of blessing on you or anything like that. They're just making demands. And then there are others who are less clear. And those are the ones that tended for me to be invisible. You know, I found myself, the more I was being hounded by others, the less that I was willing to look at these who were really the marginalized. So even in being marginalized, there's a whole range of people who, so what does it mean? Who are the poorest of the poor here? Well, there's a continuum there as well. And so this man, he at least had a bit of community surrounding him. And yesterday, actually, from this context, yesterday, a person called me. I don't know where she got my number, but she said, Pastor Steve, you gave me your number a few weeks ago. Well, that wasn't true. I don't know anybody I gave my number to a few weeks ago, and I didn't recognize her name, and I didn't recognize her voice. But anyway, she put out her desperate plea and so forth. But she made the mistake in my book of starting with saying, I'm having suicidal thoughts. So as I listened to her story, I was less and less convinced that there were suicidal thoughts involved, and more and more convinced that she was simply looking for financial assistance. But she didn't even have a clear assessment of need. And anyway, we eventually Dorothy called 911 and asked what they thought. Community assistance. Yeah, and then anyway, I'm getting the details wrong. So at any rate, the point is that when we spoke with 911, 911 said, well, regardless of what else she's dealing with, the concern is about this threat of suicide. And when I shared that back to the woman who said she had called the emergency assistance number and so forth and said they can't do anything till Monday, et cetera, the person on 911 said, the immediate concern is the suicide. When I communicated that to the woman, she said, but I'm out on the street with my kids, you know, which, so her concern wasn't really the suicide, it was the financial assistance. And so anyway, what is our role? What is my role in responding to these needs that present themselves? So Peter, or John and Peter, their attention was drawn to this man. And the interesting thing in my book is that Peter and John, he was looking at them, and they stopped and looked at him, but not just anyway. How did they look at him? Was being carried in. Every day people would place him at the temple gate, known as the Beautiful Gate, so he could ask for money from those who were entering the temple. When he saw Peter and John about to enter, he began to ask them for a gift. Peter and John stared at him. So this version says, stared at him. Other interpretations, what did yours say? Looked straight. Others say, looked intently at him. And then, what did they say to him? But look at us. So he's looking at them, wanting to, when he got their attention, he wants to ask them for alms. But then they look at him and say, you look at us. And he looks at them. And then it's in that exchange that they respond saying the kindergarten song or whatever Bible school song, you know, silver and gold have I none, but such as I have give I thee in the name of Jesus Christ, rise up and walk. Well, the thing that's interesting to me is not only does this little story capture that staring intently and focused attention on each other in this story, Peter offers his right hand. Now, how do we think of the right hand in this culture? Dominant, yeah, so left-handed, right-handed. But what more do we think there? I guess I'll answer my own question, because it seems like nobody's catching my... The left, if you offer somebody your left hand, does that mean anything in this context? The unclean hand. Yeah. You know, it's used for other functions, right? So that left hand is not the friendly hand. And the right hand, we often or used to use the term extending the right hand of fellowship. You know, the right hand is viewed as offering a hand of welcome. So not only did Peter offer touch, physical touch, he offered that right hand of fellowship and interaction, of validating and recognizing his presence. And then Peter raised him up, and at once the ankles of the man became strong. And then what's his response? What's the song say? Yeah. Walking and leaping, and you know, even Chris felt compelled to leap and walk or whatever that was he was doing. So the response, Mennonite dancing. Yeah, there you go. So the appropriate response here in this story is what? Praise to God. Now, to me, that was very striking because it wasn't Peter and John don't say, stop him from walking and leaping and praising God. No, they recognize that this man's response is to recognize what God has done in his life. And so for me, when I look at this story and I look at the fact that he wanted to be transported every day to the beautiful gate, to sit at the edge of the gate, that his heart's desire was to commune with God. His heart's desire was to be in fellowship with others, praising God together. And so when he was healed, his response was immediate. His response was to do the thing he had always longed to do, and that was participate in the temple. The thing that I see in this passage is that I am called to be attentive to what's going on around. We are all invited to be attentive. And that means taking time to stop and look and make a relationship with the person. So instead of simply looking over the crowd, here this man's calling out, even though he's not calling out their names, they become aware that he's looking at them and they stop to look at him. And they don't just look at him in a way that is dismissive, sort of like me walking through the crowd a few days ago there in Alexandria, and by a certain point in time, I just did not want to deal with this guy. There was another, or these children really, and there was another time earlier down down in Aswan, where, you know, we were on this boat and we just got up the boat and just wanted to take a boat, walk along the Nile. And these different people were coming up and hounding us, you know, and no, the market's this way, the market's this way, you're going the wrong direction and it's unsafe and blah, 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 blah. And that's not what my need was. I did not need to walk into a market. Sorry, that was zero on my list at that point in time. And eventually this guy, claiming he was from the boat and he was one of the chefs and all this business and, you know, so forth, I finally turned on him and got really ticked off with him and told him to leave us alone and went on. And, you know, even though I did that with ease in a certain sense, in another sense, I feel like, why do I let somebody like that have that kind of power over my emotion? You know, maybe I could have turned to him and said, you know, I'm simply not going to let you spoil my day, you know, and please just leave us alone. No, I had to get angry with him. And so anyway, there again, it gets back to this Psalm 130 where My center is ever present with me. There's so much I still have to deal with. But anyway, there are people I deliberately look away from and turn away from responding to their need. And so I'm not saying that we don't have to establish boundaries, but on the other hand, we need to really be open at least to looking at and considering the situation before us and inviting them to look at us and then have the exchange based on a relationship rather than categories. So that's the first little bit from this story that I wanted to look at. The second thing is that Peter and John recognized what they had to give and what they didn't have to give. You know, they didn't just say, "No, I have nothing," which is something I say fairly easily. "No, I don't have anything." "Well, what about that lump in your pants pocket?" "No, that's not for you. That's for other things." You know, but there's a sense in which I too easily can misrepresent myself. And it's not that it's pretending that I don't have money. It's denying that I have money for them. You know? But I have a free choice. I could have given it to them. So maybe it would be more accurate for me to say, you know, "I don't have silver and gold to give you. I have silver and gold, but I don't have it to give you. But what I have, I'll give you." I don't know. I really don't know. But I tend to far too easily lie about my financial situation and say, "I'm just not going there. So don't even talk about this." When Peter and John gave the man healing or participated in the healing of the man, they didn't talk to him about salvation. They didn't make it a conditional relationship. The only thing they were doing is saying, "We are entering into a relationship with you, and we offer you healing in the name of Jesus. We're not doing it in our own name. We're not looking to be worshiped ourselves. No, we're wanting to point to Jesus in what we're doing. And so we offer this right hand of fellowship, and we pull you up to your feet, inviting you to walk in newness of life." And the fact that he understood meant that he was receiving through them the very thing that his heart desired. So the point of it is that we are invited to use our gifts for the purposes of enhancing and raising up God's redemptive work in our community. And for me, that whole thing of getting these windows done, it's sort of the next layer of work that is there before we transform this space into what it is going to be for the future, instead of based on what it's been in the past. So anyway, I'm grateful for that. And I'm grateful for this place that we are in our journeys together. And I feel very encouraged in the way that we are making use of this space, making use of the old chapel and so on and so forth. It just feels to me that we're moving in a very good way and that God will honor and bless and draw people to this space, saying and recognizing that it's God who is doing this in and through us.